On the panel this afternoon, we have one member who, in fact, did not give a presentation earlier this afternoon, and that's Professor Hugo de Clare. Hugo is Professor of Glaciology at the Free University of Brussels in Belgium, and he has been involved in Antarctic research since 1965, and also in the mechanisms of the Antarctic Treaty Consultative meetings since 1999. So welcome to the panel, Hugo. I wonder if, as a start-off to this afternoon's discussions, I could ask you, having been exposed to these three presentations, whether I could invite you to make any observations on any of them.
Well, I was not only exposed, I enjoyed them. And I was, and in addition to the fascinating evolution that David has been explaining about the change in activities of SCAR and of also in the meaning of SCAR, I would like to add just a small comment with respect to the motivation of the different nations with respect to their acceding to the ATCM, to the Antarctic Treaty. Initially, of course, the requirements were to have scientific activities, significant scientific activities, and that included, as one of, it was understood at that time certainly, that they should have construct a base or a station. While at present time, of course, the scientific activities are still very required, but now the accent is on the minimal the environmental footprint. And this has led, of course, to, I think, to sharing of platforms, sharing of stations, and has much helped to the IPY and the collaboration between different nations. So I think this is a very good evolution. And at the same time, of course, it has changed a little bit, and some people regret it, that it might in the future deviate the scientific research maybe a little bit from the fundamental research to research really supporting the environmental issues. And that is a concern which comes from the scientists from time to time. That's what I wanted to add.
Well, thank you for that. I'd like to come back to SCAR issues probably later in this discussion, but I realise there were probably some constraints on our speakers earlier this afternoon. I detected there were some constraints of time, and undoubtedly certain issues would have been expanded on if there had been more time. And in that respect, just turning to, I would like to pose, I have got a number of questions from the audience on cards, but I would like to, in some ways, kick off this afternoon by addressing those constraints. And there were two issues that fascinated me in Tucker's talk, where he quite clearly indicated that he couldn't go into details. And I wonder if, in fact, he would like to expand on those points now. One was on the question of what he termed bifocalism, and it would be useful to hear more on that issue. And the second point was where he alluded to the transformation from the ill-fated CRAMRA, the Minerals Convention, through to the Environmental Protocol. So if you'd like the opportunity now, Tucker, to pick up on those two points, I think it would be very useful.
Well, let me start with the second one last. And I think the statute of limitations on going into details has run out, so I will try. No, just I think the reason, the time constraints, the Minerals Convention, I think the issues posed by the Minerals Convention were, in fact, I think, posed the greatest challenge to, quote-unquote, Antarctic governance during at least my involvement in the treaty system. The point was made this morning about how that if there had been real resource interest in Antarctica, all bets might have been off in terms of, you know, when the treaty was negotiated. But I think, in fact, CRAMRA was a response, and it was quite an amazing achievement to negotiate by consensus an agreement to deal with what was seen as potentially the most valuable resources that could exist in Antarctica, and that were the most jealously guarded. Whose management would be the most jealously guarded aspects of sovereignty. Now, the convention fell apart for a variety of reasons, one of which was, I think, the issue that there was an effective campaign launched by environmental groups and others who were saying to say that, you know, the idea of mineral resource activities in and of themselves is something alien and anathema as far as Antarctica goes. And thus the movement for a prohibition on mineral resource activities grew, came to be irresistible. I'm not sure those were the reasons that led the first countries to withdraw from the protocol, to withdraw from CRAMA, that those were exactly their reasons, but certainly the force of that movement became one that was irresistible in the long run. But it did pose a major challenge, and the challenge wasn't just that an agreement fell apart, although in fact the agreement is still there in one sense, in that if you look at the provisions of the protocol that prohibit mineral source activities, those provisions can be changed at some point, but only if a regime is in place. If you go back and read the provisions of the protocol, even with those very strong, you'd have to have consensus of everybody to end the prohibition on mineral resource activities, and it could only take place after 50 years. But even then, it could only be done according to the provisions of that article if there were a regime in place to deal with mineral resource activities. But at any rate, the reason I say that the crisis wasn't just one that related to the falling apart of a particular agreement, it was that what was proposed to replace it. Because the proposals to replace the CRAMA were not simply proposals that there be a quote-unquote prohibition on mineral resource activities. They were proposals for comprehensive environmental agreements, which would include a prohibition on mineral resource activities. And if you looked at those proposals, they dealt with, aside from the minerals activity issue, they dealt with precisely what the treaty dealt with. And thus you would have had a situation, had those proposals succeeded, in that there would have been, in fact, a competing agreement, and that really would have raised the question of the validity of the Antarctic Treaty as the framework for governance in Antarctica. And I think the protocol, therefore, the protocol itself represented a very important step in that it restored consensus among the treaty parties on a fundamental issue, which was not only the minerals issue, but the fundamental issue of what was the framework. And the deal, as it were, was that there would be a prohibition of mineral resource activities, but the elements of a comprehensive convention would be, in fact, become a protocol to the treaty, which would rationalize and deal with strengthening and making legally binding a whole range of measures that are set forth in the various annexes to the treaty. There are a number of other elements of the protocol, but that was one of the points I wanted to emphasize. And in addition to the points that I think I did touch upon, that the negotiations of the mineral resource activity, the negotiations on minerals, not only led to this environmental reaction, it also led to forces that opened up the treaty in a number of significant ways in terms of observer participation, increasing the rapid expansion in numbers of consultative parties, and the accordance of a role for non-consultative parties at the treaty meetings themselves. Sorry to take up so much time. But.
I mean, just before we move on to that other issue of bifocalism, I take questions if people want to raise them on that specific point that Tuck has just been talking about.
Yes.
There's a microphone just to your side.
As Tucker knows, and what the specific words are, mineral resources activities other than scientific research are prohibited. Yeah. And I was concerned as an earth scientist doing research in Antarctica, and shared by some of my colleagues, that this was implying that scientific research was a mineral resource activity. However, on better consideration, it excludes, objectors could say any earth science research would be a mineral resource activity, therefore you can't do geology or whatever. So in fact, that specific caveat is very good for scientific research, and I think that needs to be remembered, that it's prohibited other than mineral resources activities.
Well, I appreciate both your question and your answer. So.
Well, there's another question.
Jan Tiede. I was very with great interest listening to the remarks of Tucker Scully about the mineral resource regime and the decisions which have been followed up. But then Dr. Mary Jacobson mentioned the investigations for the EEZs conducted by a number of countries along the coral margins of Antarctica. So how is this is this not in conflict with the protocol? Does anybody dare to answer?
I assume it was directed to Marie, right?
Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, why not? But I first like to... I actually... thank you for posing the question. But I actually would like to say a few words on the camera as well. I agree very much with Tucker about the challenge that the crackdown of camera posed to the Antarctic Treaty system and the Antarctic Treaty parties, because we mustn't forget that at the time the treaty system was under a great challenge by critics at the UN, and the criticism at the UN really led partly to those who really decided to join the treaty because of the negotiations of CRAMRA, probably believing that it would be better to be in than to be out, to be cynical. And it's very, very interesting. If you go through the criticism in the UN, in the statements, none, and I assure you, of the statements in the UN up till 1989 contained any reference to the protection of the environment. And then when CRAMRA, it was clear that CRAMRA wouldn't survive, and there were all these, there were five proposals on a new regulation of Antarctic, of the protection of the Antarctic environment. And one very important came from Chile, by the way. The discussions in the UN as such changed, and all those who were critical of the negotiations of the Antarctic mineral regime became then the most forefront environmentalist that you could ever believe. So you can see in the statements very, very clearly that all of a sudden everybody was in favor of the environment, and the criticism against the Antarctic Treaty parties was directed to the fact that they did not take care of the environment. So there was an external pressure, and then there was an internal problem. I think in the end it was very, very good that we had the protocol, and that the protocol turned out as we have it now. I think that meant a lot.
I wonder if I could come back to the issue of EEZs just later in this discussion. It would have been a question that you could have posed this morning, but we won't forget about it. It's an important point. There's just one point I'd like to make to reinforce the comment that Tucker just made, is that, of course, the protocol is subsidiary to the treaty, subservient to the treaty. And I must admit that in 1990, certainly in London, when one was in this sort of limbo land, consensus had been lost and there were major concerns. And we certainly in London were very concerned that if one had a freestanding convention, a conservation convention, for example, then it could very rapidly compete with, in fact, out-compete with the treaty itself, given that the vast majority of the developing agenda was, in fact, environmental. So, in fact, instead of going for a competing convention, one, in fact, arrived at this protocol. Right, bifocalism.
I'll take my glasses off with this one. The only reason I wanted to elaborate a little more on that is that I think it's often, the Article 4 of the treaty, and I think Gillian touched on the fact that it is, in fact, a dynamic article. It's not simply a setting-aside article. But it's often seen simply as being one in which it's the parties are assumed to simply have said, we're setting aside the issue of territorial claims and non-recognition thereof, et cetera. And it's almost as if it's something, setting aside and we'll have to come back to it at some point. Whereas I think in reality what Article 4 and combined with other provisions of the treaty do is to create a situation where, in fact, you do not have to resolve those issues and you do not have to ever resolve those issues as a basis for taking comment action in Antarctica. And I think it was proven in, particularly in the negotiation of Camelot, where the Article 4 principles were transferred and modified slightly to take account of the marine environment, and in Cramer, because it was argued, when I first got into the treaty business, it was argued, well, Article 4 is all well and good when you're talking about science and peaceful purposes, but when you're getting down to economic activity, it's probably not going to work. But in fact, it did with both of those agreements. And so someone once asked me, how would you describe that? And the example and I've used this in the past, is, you know, how would you describe bifocalism in practice? What does it really mean? And you can take an example of, and let's go back to scientific research, you could take an example of a scientist from a non-claimant country doing research in Antarctica in an area that's claimed by, let's say an American scientist doing research in the New Zealand claimed area. Under the treaty, New Zealand can say that in fact it has given its consent to that research because of Article 2 of the treaty itself, provided that that scientist meets the obligations in the treaty, which means that the plans were shared in advance and the results are made available after the research. So New Zealand can say this is perfectly consistent. This American scientist is doing research in a manner that's perfectly consistent with our sovereignty over, the Ross Dependency, as they call it. Now, the Americans could say, well, that's absolute rubbish. There is no sovereignty in Antarctica, and the only country that has the right to regulate an American scientist, a U.S. scientist, in Antarctica is the United States through its jurisdiction over its nationals wherever they are. But by becoming a party to the treaty, we have in fact agreed to apply those obligations that are contained in the treaty, meaning plans in advance, results afterwards, to that scientific research. Therefore, that research is taking place in a manner that's perfectly consistent with our view that this is an area beyond anybody's jurisdiction. Each side can be perfectly whole in its legal position, but the common obligations apply to the research. Agreed obligations apply, and it goes forward subject to those obligations. Now, that, in fact, it seems to me, what has been done both with all of the activities under the treaty, and has been transferred into the realm of living resources with Camelot. And would have been with the Minerals Convention as well.
Yes, yeah. I think what Taki has said is very important. Now, coming from a non-claimant state, we very often rely on Article 4 as well. You don't have to be a claimant state to rely on. It is as important for the non-claimant states. So, for example, when there are situations there might be one or two states that protest against another, a claimant state's behavior for some reason or another. Very often, Sweden has never really protested, and because we always rely on Article 4 and says that this is what we live with. There is no need for us to put forward an official note of protest or whatever to the other, because we rely entirely on Article 4. And that is our sort of contribution, not to enhance the tensions and rather instead helping us to keep it to a good sort of cooperative regime.
I know I've got two questions out in the audience. It's like being in a sort of, the stage lights here are quite bright, and you are very gloomy. If you want to catch my attention, wave your card or something. But there's a question from Jorge Begunia and then from Rudy Wolfram. Jorge. Could you
say that if one would say, Tucker, that there is no sovereignty, I understand that. But if one would say there is no jurisdiction in Antarctica, besides the specific jurisdiction that states have on the nationals, then, of course, you couldn't have had a convention on the minerals, because, in fact, the minerals is the exercise of a joint jurisdiction of the parties. And my view would be then that there is a joint jurisdiction without minerals. I mean, there is a joint jurisdiction which exercises these powers on the Antarctic continent in the interest of humanity, but not as a UN mandate. That's right. It's a question and a counter-argument.
Well, I assume that's directed at least initially to me. I take the counter argument. I'm not sure I would agree with it necessarily. And of course, Cramer, when you look at Cramer, it did something very different with regard to how mineral resource activities would have been regulated by creating regulatory committees. And that was quite a breakthrough in terms of jurisdiction, if you will, from your perspective in Antarctica. But Cramer did not, in fact, well, has not, let's say, seen the light of day and may never, obviously. But, I mean, I think that was a departure, because the regulatory committee concept, where you were actually looking at a more limited group of countries making at least initial decisions about whether or not activities might go forward, was, in fact, a significant departure in terms of jurisdiction. But I would distinguish here in terms of the quote-unquote bifocalism of that from the issue of whether or not the Antarctic is an accepted regime in terms of its collective capacity to provide for governance. I think that has, in fact, been established. And just to add a point, because I think Mari mentioned this, that was challenged, and during the course of, again, the minerals negotiation, this issue was raised in the United Nations. There was a challenge to the legitimacy of the treaty parties at least dealing with this resource issue posed in the UN. But in fact, that was put to rest. Interestingly enough, there was a consensus agreement on language which was approved by all, which related to endorsing essentially the validity of the Antarctic Treaty, provided that the parties to the treaty continued and improved the distribution of, if you will, the benefits of the Antarctic Treaty, meaning the information about the scientific research and the scientific data. And that was included in Agenda 21 in the Rio conference in 1992 in the oceans chapter for some reason, because there wasn't a polar chapter. And I think that then led to the issue becoming basically one where there was an agenda item but no debate in New York, and then finally removal of the agenda item itself.
I want to come back to what Tucker said about that we don't have to, really go from Germany, that we don't have to decide on the sovereignty issue, and I believe that's really the basis for the working method of the Antarctic Treaty. Even the regulatory committees under Cramra did not take a decision in that respect. In the regulatory committees, we always had both sides. And therefore, here again, it was not taking a decision in this respect. Apart from that, this group had, so to speak, joint jurisdiction. You're right. In that respect, it was a further development, but still, the primary principle of the Antarctic Treaty was safeguarded in this respect.
I totally agree with you there. Yeah. I was just trying to make the point on Jorge's point of separating sovereignty from jurisdiction.
Yeah. No. But we have still a problem. What is the situation if a non-treaty state, let's say Chad, starts doing scientific research in Antarctica or in the continental shelf? That is a problem. In Cramra, there was the attempt to find a provision to that extent. It says very mildly that all the states, parties to Cramra, would encourage that state to join, or et cetera, et cetera. But here we have a weak spot in that whole regime. It relies on the fact that everybody who is engaged is part of the club, but cannot ensure that situation. That's a problem which still prevails. It has never become a reality or a problem. But in theory, that's a weak point in the Antarctic Treaty system.
But I think it is in theory, because the club is pretty powerful. And presumably any state outside of the system that wished to take that sort of cavalier attitude would come under intense diplomatic and other pressures.
Yes, right, Mike. But if you look into the rules under the Straddling Fish Stock Conventions and the regulatory approach they take, here there is the states parties involved take quite a tough action against those who come from the outside. The Antarctic Treaty System doesn't go that far. In this respect, Law of the Sea Convention, or the Law of the Sea, has moved further ahead than the Antarctic Treaty System.
Murray, do you want to react to that?
Yes, if I can. But, I mean, what you raise now is, of course, the traditional problem of the Pacta Tacis rule, that the treaty cannot bind non-state parties, and that the treaty has to develop into some sort of an objective regime, etc. And I don't believe that the Antarctic Treaty is there, but although that the number of the provisions in the treaty have become customary law, one could argue. But I think that when it comes to the Antarctic Treaty System, that you said that it's a weak point, I think that if you move from the treaty itself and you go to CAMELAR, I think CAMELAR has had to address this issue on quite a number of bases, inviting new states to participate, as you know, creating new forms for those who are not yet parties, etc. And I think that then CAMELAR has really been a good role model for how one should manage it. Of course, there is an ambition, for those of you who don't know it, in the treaties, in all treaties, that the treaty parties, be it in the Antarctic Treaty itself or in CAMELAR or whatever, they should attempt to try to make sure that everybody acts in accordance to this treaty. And this is very carefully drafted, because on all occasions when we have a new convention negotiated under the Antarctic Treaty, the treaty parties were very well aware that they could not oblige non-state parties to be bound by the treaty itself. Now, the tricky question is not really this classical rule of international law, but how you deal with the claimants in this particular case, because they would naturally think that, of course, I mean, if I was from a claimant state, I would argue, well, I can at least use my own national law to enforce it. And Gillian Triggs addressed one of these aspects this morning. But the thing is that there is a common understanding between non-claimants and claimants here. But, of course, I mean, you're perfectly right. I just wanted to widen the discussion a little.
Jim.
Yeah. I personally think the trickiest problem we're facing now, and have been for about a decade, is the large illegal fishery that seems to be outside of the ability of CAMELAR and its parties to control. It's a huge amount of activity. It's worth a lot of money. It's killing a lot of albatrosses and petrels as bycatch as well. It's very pernicious, and we haven't really found a solution to it yet. And most of those parties that are involved, we think, are non-Antarctic Treaty parties, although some of them appear to be even Antarctic Treaty parties, and still, we can't close the loop on that. Do you all have any comments about that?
Well, I was just wondering in that respect, I mean, it is a major problem, and we've been grappling with it for years, but I just wonder if that question and that whole issue would not be better addressed. Denzel's probably somewhere lurking at the back. I mean, is that a point that can be picked up later in the week, Denzel? I mean, and so we won't forget it. We were just talking about weaknesses in the system, and there's a very generic question here, which I suspect we could probably spend most of the day on, or perhaps the rest of the week on. The question is, what do you think are the biggest weaknesses in the Antarctic Treaty and CAMELAR, and what are your recommendations for addressing them? I'm not sure necessarily that one could instantaneously come up with answers, but perhaps that's a question that we might want to reflect on over the coming days, and perhaps generally develop an answer.
To use an Antarctic aphorism, we've met the enemy and it is us. So if one looks at the weaknesses of the system, I think one needs to look first internally.
So I'm not trying to avoid the issue to whoever addressed that question, but I say perhaps we could just bear that one in mind. I wonder if I could actually turn to some of the questions that that we got over the coffee break. There's one here. There's one here that's actually addressed to Tucker, but I think I might pass it to both Murray Jacobson and Tucker Scully.
That would be an active chair.
And and they both relate to the... There's another one here, I think, that's similar. I can't find it. Let me just deal with this one to start with. It goes along the lines of Article 7... Oh, no, this is the expeditions one. I'm trying to find one about Article 6. Where's it gone? Oh, here we go. This is a question to Tucker Scully, but as I say, it's, I think, an issue about law and governance. It goes, you mentioned Article 6 of the Antarctic Treaty protecting high seas rights of states. Could you discuss what are the concrete implications of that provision, or what the concrete implications of that provision might mean today? And there's a similar question along the same lines, which goes along as follows. Why has the historical evolution of the treaty system resulted in the proliferation of standalone legal instruments regulating activities in the Antarctic? Will this trend continue, and if not, why?
I'd like to turn the Article 6 to Mari, if she'd like to take it.
Why is that? Is there
because I'm not a lawyer.
Well, I mean, I think that the Article 6 issue, the article that preserves the high seas freedom, was exactly the outcome of the knowledge and of those who negotiated the treaty, that they could not create a treaty that would bind non-state actors. That is simply out of the question. They could create a treaty which would bind or put a restriction on themselves through national measures. But there was also another aspect to Article 6 at the time of the negotiation, and that related to the use of military exercises and explosion and other type of military activities that is clearly prohibited on Antarctica, the continent, but which there were no agreement during the negotiations that should also cover the sea areas. And some of the states were very, very concerned to maintain the right to freedom of navigation in the area. When the treaty parties were first faced with a need to negotiate CCAS, the Seals Convention, they were forced legally to go outside the treaty because they needed to create a regime that would be legally applicable also to the high seas area. And this is also, I know that you probably want to say something about the convergence and Camelot and say that this, you have a very good point there that you say that this did not really relate to Camelot, but in a sense it does. It's the same there. You have to address the areas clearly outside the Antarctic Treaty if you want to address a freedom that is clearly the freedom of the high seas as it used to be, namely fishing. Then you have to deal with a separate treaty. Now, so if there is a need to conclude more agreements of the kind, you might need a separate treaty. But you might also do, when there is no such need, you might do what you did with the protocol, that you were able to squeeze it in under the Antarctic Treaty itself. Now, that, of course, could be a legal theoretical debate whether the protocol is a separate treaty or whether it did modify the Antarctic Treaty or not, because the aim, of course, was not the Antarctic Treaty is like the UN Charter. You don't touch it. You sort of modify, develop, etc. within the Antarctic Treaty. But this is the basic difference. You need to regulate sea areas that are high seas, where you have high seas right, you need a separate regime.
Are we running into difficulties where we actually get different parties to different elements of the Antarctic Treaty system? And whilst Camelot might have an obligation on those parties to adhere to all the provisions of the treaty itself, I mean, we are getting within Camelot, for example, what you could not necessarily term traditional Antarctic Treaty parties. I mean, they are fishing states, effectively, but they've joined up to Camelot. They are theoretically bound by the provisions of the Antarctic Treaty, but we are starting to see a disparity in the membership of the various instruments.
I think that's in respect of Camelot is all to the good. I think that's why if you look at the criterion for accession to membership in the Commission of Camelot, it's an activities criterion, but it's not the same activities criterion as the Antarctic Treaty. And I think the primary reason for there being a separate convention, while the Article 6 issue may have been there, I think the Article 6 issue was diminishing at that time. It was really because you needed to go to the convergence to be able to, as Scar had recommended, to be able to deal with the entire ecosystem. And you would have had a truncated convention. In fact, I think that's something the issue of the convergence is something the treaty should be dealing with itself. A final point, though, with regard to Article 6, I think you can argue in a way, I mean, we have already a provision of the treaty in the form of Annex 4 to the protocol that does apply to the marine areas south of 60. Now, you can argue that because of the cross, if you will, the cross-fertilization with IMO, I think there are some parties to the Antarctic Treaty that are parties to Annex 4 that are not parties to IMO, or at least to the IMO special area provision. So, in fact, you do have an example of an instrument that is applied to the high, quote-unquote, high seas areas with respect to marine pollution in the treaty itself through Annex 4 of the protocol.
Have you got a microphone there? Can we get a... And then there's a question at the back afterwards.
Anders Karkvist from Sweden. Since we have two scientists on the panel as well, I'd like to put a question or an observation which relates to what Professor de Clercq said in his introduction, namely the fact that the treaty during these 50 years has gone from a secret old boys club to an open forum. And the openness is reflected in many ways. And one way, of course, is that the criteria for being a consultative member has changed, although the basic idea of having substantial scientific research remains. But the interpretation of that has changed over time. And I would like to hear if you have any reflection of or interpretation of that evolution towards openness, and especially what will happen in the future in terms of the criteria for actually acceding or being a consultative status given to new members.
I mean, personally, I thought one of the most interesting developments was that when the Netherlands became a consultative party, because they hadn't got a base in Antarctica with the Netherlands flag outside. But nevertheless, they were doing very credible work, either in or above Antarctica. And that was, I thought that changed the issue somewhat. But there is a tension where, on the one hand, you say you've got to be doing significant science. And unfortunately, nations also equate that with you've got to have a base and a flag. And I think there's a degree of tension there. We still haven't overcome that.
Can I comment on that?
Surely, David.
The question of the hurdle you have to jump to become a consultative party is an interesting one. The definition of what constitutes an acceptable level and quality of research has, of course, never been defined. The lawyers wouldn't want to define it because that actually reduces the flexibility. So if you try to look at the research that's been done by a number of the more recent parties who've joined the treaty, you see that the amount of research which they have accomplished before requesting consultative status, in at least some cases, is significantly less than would have been accepted at an earlier stage. And that's because as far as I'm aware, the treaty has never said that you can't become a consultative party because your research isn't good enough. That would be diplomatically difficult to deal with. What we could say is that there are other mechanisms out there which have been used by a number of countries to determine what the quality of their Antarctic research is. So some countries do internal assessments of the quality of their research, and some countries actually do international assessments. And Finland is a recent consultative party. They wanted to know, having become a consultative party, was their research any good? They appointed an international committee to come and make an assessment of the research, which it did. And then, to everyone's amazement, they actually published the results of the international committee, which was highly critical of the research that Finland was doing, saying that in some cases they were simply wasting their money. The quality was actually rubbish. Now that's an unusual decision by a consultative party to actually wash their dirty linen in public. But it's a way forward, because Finland has now changed the way in which it's doing its research. Other countries, like South Africa, has had a recent assessment. Germany's had a recent assessment. The Netherlands has had a recent assessment. But none of those assessments have ever been published in the same way. So it's not possible to see what the independent assessment of the research is. Now, the UK asked in an inspection report that Mike was responsible for, presented to the treaty some years ago, asked if SCAR would actually undertake a review of the quality of research undertaken by the consultative parties around the Antarctic, which I think is the heart of the question. And SCAR isn't in the business of actually undertaking that sort of review, so it was refused. But it is, I think, an important issue, because Antarctic research is expensive, and it's not simply the authority that goes with being a consultative party, but actually could that investment be better spent on good science? And so I believe that one of the weaknesses of the treaty at the moment is that it will not investigate the quality of the science that it's doing, and it doesn't actually want to know in many cases whether or not it's actually doing better or worse than other people. It simply wants to sit at the table.
I know that you answered me negatively when I posed that question in relation to science generally and the consultative parties, but one could pose another question, David, which would probably also produce a negative answer. SCAR has no role in evaluating the science of a prospective consultative party. Mm. The parties do that themselves, sort of nationally, and as you say, politically, they probably wouldn't want to turn down a candidate country. But actually, in terms of providing scientific advice, you might feel it politicises SCAR to actually be given that question, but it's quite a legitimate question to pose to SCAR. Here's a candidate country. In your opinion, is the science up to it?
It's an interesting question, and I certainly wouldn't know what the answer to that is as far as SCAR is concerned at the moment. It does, to some extent, politicise the decision. But I'm suggesting that you don't have to go down that road. You can actually appoint an international committee that will assess the quality of the science and report back independently of SCAR in the case of an application of consultative status. Why not?
Good idea. I know I have two questions. I think there's Denzel Miller at the back and Olaf down here at the front.
Thank you very much. I think the first thing I'd like to say is a comment, but the panel might like to take it as a question. And that's the question I think, Mike, you referred to, or might have been Tucker, to regulatory committees under CRAMRAR. And the parallel that sprang to mind to me would be a quota allocation system under CAMELAR, which was a collective system of allocation of rights for fishing. We don't have that system, but it is a system that's characteristic of other RFMOs. I think the other question is probably going back to Marie, which would be something along the lines of, would you see at any time in the future that there would be a necessity in terms of the kind of conditions that you outlined with respect to Article 6 and that relationship with respect to the SEALS Convention and CAMELAR, that would need to apply to the continental shelf in the future?
Thank you. I'll take you now. The continental shelf issue came back, so I'll address that. Thanks for the question. But let me just first say something about the consultative status. I think there is a great misunderstanding about the wording of the Antarctic Treaty when it comes to consultative status. There is nothing in the treaty that says that the treaty parties, the consulted already existing treaty parties, have the right to decide theoretically on when a new party or when a new state that is already a party to the Antarctic Treaty becomes a consultative party. The wording, I mean, becoming a consultative party means that you have the decision-making power. You get the right to take part in decision. And the wording of the treaty says that each contracting party, which has been become party to the Antarctic Treaty, shall be entitled to appoint representatives to participate in meetings, etc., during such time. And then comes the description of the scientific activities. Now, the treaty parties, the Antarctic consultative parties, have wrestled with how one should formulate then what is de facto scrutinization and acceptance of a non-consultative party to become or to have this right to take part in the decision. And during that process, we have examples, and I'm not going to point them out here, but we have examples where the consultative parties have been of the view that the level of science is not up to standards, doesn't meet the criteria in the Antarctic Treaty. But it is a very, very tricky question and legally difficult to phrase. But if you go through the Antarctic Treaty report, you will see how carefully formulated the sentences are that say that one state is elevated from a non-consultative status to a consultative status. On the issue of the continental shelf, I think that if it is difficult, I don't think that you need or will have or are likely to have, you will be likely to have a treaty which says the continental shelf convention of the Antarctic in Antarctica. I don't think that will be the case. But I think it might be the case that if the treaty parties to meet challenges in discussing, for example, bioprospecting and genetic resources, will have to address also issues on the continental shelf, there might be a need for a regulation that also includes the continental shelf. I know that there is a great... this is not something that the treaty parties want at this time. But given the discussions in the international community on the bioprospecting and genetic resources and the misperceptions of what it means in terms of everything from environmental damage or threat to the environment to the problem of very, very elementary patent rights and individual rights, this is something that in one way or another the treaty parties will have to address. And that's where I might think that it might come in. But when I raised the issue of the continental shelf in my presentation, it was really the problem that we have seen a number of submissions to the Continental Shelf Commission under UNCLOS, also from claimant states, and they've kept that very close to themselves. So it's been the claimant states plus the US and Russia that have been discussing this, and the other non-claimant states, the consultative parties, have not at all been really involved in this. And that has caused frustration among some of the parties, because then we're talking about, I mean, we already have a group of the original signatories, etc., but we're talking about a sort of differentiation of members in the treaty. And if we are going down that way, I think that would be as much threat to the treaty as we had during the disruption of PRIMA.
Tucker, do you want to make a comment? And I'll ask Olaf, he's got a question.
Denzel made another point, but first of all, with respect to the continental shelf, I mean, of course, Camelar already applies to the continental shelf, and it regulates creatures of the shelf, so it deals. And I think the same approach could be taken with respect to bioprospecting. You just define the species, in broad categories of what you're dealing with, and you regulate them wherever they are, including on the continental shelf. But that just brings back a point I wanted to make about the Minerals Convention. The Minerals Convention basically had, in terms of where it applied, it had a solution which basically said the minerals regime, CRAMA, will apply to the Antarctic continent and the adjacent offshore areas, but without encroachment on the deep seabed. I think that's something that probably we should have included in the protocol as to where the ban on mineral resource activities applied. I think that would have been quite useful for the future. With respect to group quotas, I mean, the idea of regulatory committees as a model for quotas under CAMELAR, again, I'm not sure that, it can work in the same way, but I do think that there's going to have to be, at some point, CAMELAR is going to have to deal with the issue of how you apportion effort to national interests in fishing. Now, there may be other ways of doing it, even on a vessel-by-vessel basis, but that issue certainly will come up.
Olaf, you've been patiently sitting there. All right.
Sorry for taking the floor, having talked this morning. But this issue of becoming a consultative member and also the idea that we would be moving down the line where the environmental research might be something different from the fundamental research, which Hugo referred to earlier today. Let me start by one point. The Antarctic Treaty says, and it's in your book so you can all see it, any party is entitled to appoint representatives as long as it conducts substantial research there, and the THERE is at the last there. And that's why the Netherlands were interesting, but the argument was that the Dutch participation was many Dutch scientists were going to Antarctica. That was at that time an important point. But whether substantial research is being conducted in Antarctica today by all members that have become consultative parties is an issue that can be argued. As the word substantial, of course, is variable. I don't think it's correct that nobody has been turned down. I think parties have been asked to come. I mean, contracting parties have been asked to come back doing more research, which in fact means they were turned down the first time, maybe the second time. So there are examples of that, although they have not been made public, which is a different issue. But they're also entitled to have representatives as long as they conduct research there, whereas the 12 original parties basically are entitled to be contracting parties as forever. So there's a nuance in this, and it's going to be interesting to see if we ever have the example of somebody stopping conducting research, stopping having a station, and then deciding for themselves that they should no longer be a contracting party, which is the implication of the thing. So that was my one point. But the other one, which was made me take the floor, was this issue of where will we be going in the future. And I would say that the biggest problem we might have in the Antarctic in the future is not that we have too many people, but that we have too few people. It's much, much more expensive to conduct research in the Antarctic than anywhere else on Earth. Today there's roughly 10 or 20, 15 times more tourists going to Antarctica than there are scientists. So the scientist population is a small part of the total, although probably each science program and each scientist has a much larger footprint on the Antarctic continent than the tourist. The evolution has not been that science has been increasing. Clearly, science in the future will have to combine its efforts. Multinational expeditions and so forth will certainly be an important part of the future. But if we stop going to Antarctica because of environmental constraints, for some reason or another, then we will also be losing our knowledge of the future, of what's happening there. And so I would hope that we see more science going to Antarctica and not science sitting at home, modeling, speculating, or whatever. It's the field data that is expensive. And then we, in the future, will have to do that with a minimum footprint, but we can't stop going there.
Thank you for that. I'm conscious that we don't have much more time, and I do have a couple of questions, I think, to revert back to David on science. I just wanted to make a comment on the Minerals Convention and the marine environment. I well recall, I mean, Cramra, one had a sort of 40-plus article, very comprehensive legal instrument in terms of addressing minerals, legally comprehensive, perhaps rather fell down on its presentation, and you converted that into a one-liner, which presentationally might have looked very good, legally perhaps is less good, which is Article 7 of the protocol. And I remember, as a delegation, the UK posing a question to another delegation, saying there is a huge hole out there, and the reply was, we know that, but don't mention it. So I suspect we might have to return to that issue sometime. The other issue, just to comment on the EEZ issue, is, and I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, my understanding is that the claimant states would argue that they have an inherent right to an EEZ stemming from their claim, and they have an inherent right to a continental shelf if they can demonstrate one exists. But the issue really is whether the claimants wish to push these matters, and by sometimes doing, increasing tension within the Antarctic Treaty system. Now, certain claimants actually try and lower the tension and not push their luck. Others actually go almost as far as they can and perhaps fall over themselves, as was demonstrated this morning, because then, in fact, it comes back to bite them. But that's just a comment. But can I just ask you, David, on a cut? I've got one question here, which relates to... it says, in respect of the comment of examples of national agendas being fed into SCAR through scientists themselves, how is scholarly impartiality being maintained post-Chris Rapley's 1998 challenge? And there's a sort of subsidiary question that it says here, what happens when Antarctic scientists do get political, either intentionally or not?
Well, Antarctic scientists, believe it or not, are actually people, and they do have their own opinions. So when I was talking about SCAR's input to the treaty, I was talking about the input of the organisation as a whole. Now, I wouldn't for a moment suggest that all of the Antarctic scientists are completely apolitical beasts, because they're clearly not. You only have to stop them singing for a while and give them a pint of beer, and you'll find out that they're as political as everybody else. The question, I think, is... it's a difficult one in terms of trying to set aside your opinions and actually deal simply with the facts. And what SCAR's trying to do is provide the facts without attempting to necessarily draw the conclusion. So in the straightforward case, let's take bioprospecting. SCAR has produced a number of papers over the years on bioprospecting. And actually what it's attempted to do is lay out the potential for bioprospecting, the implications that might arise if you attack particular groups of organisms and collect them in large numbers, and then left the decision as to whether or not to allow that or whether to put regulations in place or controls or what should be the minimum level of collection and so on with the treaty. To have actually gone out and said there should be no bioprospecting would actually be a political statement, which SCAR really isn't in the business of making. That's a decision for the parties to make, and indeed some parties have made it abundantly clear that they believe bioprospecting is a reasonable activity to undertake in the Antarctic. Whether it should be regulated or not is a matter for the parties. SCAR's role is to say what would happen if you did certain sorts of things. And I think bioprospecting, which has been mentioned several times today, is a really interesting case in point, because the potential for bioprospecting exists both within the treaty and within CAMELAR. And there needs to be some agreement as to how to treat bioprospecting as an activity across both the convention and the treaty itself. And at the moment, I don't actually see how they're going to do that, but doubtless a way will be worked out. Those sorts of activities which spread outside the treaty into associated parts of the system need careful handling, and we've had a long history of dealing with protected areas that contain bits of sea, where CAMELAR claimed jurisdiction because it's in the sea, and the treaty had already designated those areas before CAMELAR had actually even been thought of. So there are precedents for coming to agreements about this which avoid the science information being seen as political. We're never going to be perfect in this, but I do believe that we can try and stick to the science and however difficult it is, allow the parties to make the decisions about policy. That's the way it should be.
I think we've almost run out of time in terms of the session. Given that our presentations today were on legal framework, governance and scientific research, it's not surprising the breadth of questions that have been posed this afternoon. I think it would be almost impossible to sum those up. We did have from the speakers, Mary Jacobson provided us earlier with, I thought, a very interesting insights into the history leading up to the adoption of the treaty itself. And then I think this afternoon further aspects have been brought out, such as the question of the high seas rights under Article 6, which in part were the genesis for other elements of the Antarctic Treaty system, starting with CCAS and so on. And Tucker, in terms of governance, I think gave us a very interesting synthesis. And then this afternoon, that's been expanded on in terms of issues like bifocalism, the consensus issue, and ecosystem management under CAMELAR. I think for many of us, at least on the diplomatic political side, the parallel history of how SCAR was evolving and how SCAR was managing itself may well have been very new to many in the room. It certainly was to me. And the observations that SCAR has forced itself to modernise was good news. So I think these three presentations this afternoon, I hope you found them interesting. I get the impression from the questions that we've had as a panel that you did find them interesting. And lastly, I would just like to thank the members of the panel for their contributions this afternoon. And before we disappear, and I'll probably fall over my microphone, I would like to present Hugo with a medal on behalf of the summit board. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And thank you all.